among a reconstruction. These are placed, however, not in a series of other Mesian documents, but curiously juxtaposed to Ferg's earlier geometric abstractions. We don't see them in these photographs, we just see the photographs, but suffice it to say the color of the wall is indeed also a part of this composition. Thus Ferg, it would seem, seeks to somehow decontextualize the Mies International style aura in the form of the mechanically reproduced photograph. Both paintings and architecture appear then to be reduced to the absent relic. I would reiterate here the theme of a consummate heroic monumentality for which individual works are made by substitution to stand in for more immediate forms. However, despite the obvious choreography of individual works, paintings, sculptures, photographs, and painted walls, their totality, I believe, remains far more important than their unique parts. And this forced totalization, in turn, tends to render each object visually similar, even redundant to the point of absurd repetition. This same ambition is also evident in the work of Gerhard Merz. Next group. Most of these are obviously in the Mesian series by Ferg. Shots of the interior, as I say, Mies van der Rohe's Haus Lange, Krefeld. Others alternate with other examples of the interior of the Haus Wittgenstein by Ludwig Wittgenstein in Vienna. Next two. Next to the actual Haus Wittgenstein, for example, in another set of documentary photos. Next to the sense of a kind of optical and spatial ambiguity here, I think, is even in these photographs fairly apparent. Next to Ferg also does a documentation, I think, for perhaps emerging reasons, having to do with certain Italian buildings of the 1920s and 30s. For example, the University of Rome complex, the faculty buildings of the University of Rome by Piacentini. And we see, once again, the classificatory efforts of the natural sciences observed here in the geology and the mineralogy buildings at the University of Rome. Next two. Next two. These are photographs, as I say. They're not actual shots of the building in situ. Next two. This same ambition is also evident in the works of Gerhard Merz. Thus, in an installation entitled Sojourn to Italy, the spectator encounters a series of framed wall panels, each identical in size and format. Particular Italian cities, Milan, Naples, Rome, Trieste, and Venice, are each cataloged by similar geometrically sparse reliefs, distinguished by assignments of densely applied color. This sensation of an assertive abstraction is immediate. Not only does their sheer opacity strike one, so does the robust monumentality of their separate frames. Every panel in sequence, despite its obvious flatness, projects a spatial authority. The cities presented, represented by their color, announce themselves in this regimented sequence as though awaiting some kind of confrontational, cognitive confrontation. Finally, on a concluding wall, Merz inscribes in a lean Helvetica text the cryptic passage, quote, "And the colors are a river, and the river is history," unquote. But what history? Color, monumentality, and order all suggest a kind of imperial antiquity. Next two. The irony here, of course, is this was installed not in Italy, but was installed in a municipal building in Munich, a civic building done under the National Socialist regime. Next two. But the absolute density, the almost complete denial of sense cast through an aesthetic scrim, suggests a more contemporary, a more paradoxical meaning. Clearly, the Northern European longing for a light, saturated Mediterranean South is being invoked by Merz. But this homily gives way quickly to a more unsettling possibility, the possibility that what we are being presented with is a once again vibrant celebration of stately Roman civilization, not this time of the ancient emperors, but of a more recent authoritarian moment. Thus, Merz's use of color, like Furug's paintings or photographs, presents the viewer with a kind of language, a language in which a social and historical truth is communicated not through literary recognition, but instead through indirection, through both rational denial and sensorial acknowledgement. Here, the authoritarian impulse thus is neither stated nor repressed, but cognitively inferred. These installations appear then to be the densified signs of a kind of totalitarian past, and they are indeed imposing. For Furug and Merz, this is surely their very purpose. While their constituent parts may appear obscure, their totality instills the chilling awe of a space produced for a thousand-year empire. The suggestion of the imperial is repeated everywhere. The authoritarian architecture of Furug's photographs, the resolute abstractness of plane geometries, the utter uniformity of monochromatic colors, the overwhelming scale of both paintings, sculptures, and photographs. Each contributes to the almost archaeological sense of a mythic past reinscribed to become a lived present. Even the portraits of young women photographed by Furug, owing to their obsessive concentration as well as sheer size, act to overwhelm the viewer with their monumental presence. Scale, repetition, materiality, and density of representational content produce in some a cryptic icon. Its aura restores cult value, and a restored erratic art serves the cult of the absolute. However, the work of these artists is not, I believe, an ordinary cult of nostalgia. Indeed, a very unique past is recalled in the installations of Furug and Merz. And this instant unavoidably points to that moment when a heroic modernism and a triumphant totalitarianism, if briefly intersected. Of course, these two things are not usually linked, but I would argue that this is exactly what their art does and what makes Furug's and Merz's art provocative now. They force us to acknowledge that modernism and totalitarianism share some of the same ideological lineages, and I would also argue some of its ambitions. They insist that we recognize that modernism and the totalitarian impulse are alike, not only in their appearance, but also in their intentions, and in fact mirror each other. In an ingenious set of reversals in which the modern and the totalitarian merge and become increasingly interchangeable, in which there is no way of deciding which is authentic art and which is simple reproduction, which is liberating and which is coercive, Furug and Merz present both in a triumphant instant of total reconciliation. In effect, they make their authoritarianism transparent, through, not despite, the intractability of their intended meanings. Yet what matters to me in this art is actually the clarity of Furug and Merz's connections between modernism and the totalitarian, in revealing the ambitions latent in modernism and likewise the idealized concerns at the root of the authoritarian. It is not that the artists themselves advocate either historical position. Neither seeks to advance totalitarianism, I believe, nor to devalue modernism. What they instead try to do is to suggest how seamless their convergence in history for one particular moment actually was. Both movements shared a common desire to establish once and for all a unity of art and society. It is a vision that is most evident in the architectural character of geometrically abstract painting. Authoritarian regimes, however, have typically regarded modern painting and sculpture negatively. But curiously, they have frequently intended to favor, if not the forms, then at least the ambitions behind modern architecture, particularly its claims to a universal and absolute validity. Ferg and Merz's installations offer hints of these architectural ambitions. Yet this is the modernist architecture not of functionalism, but of the heroically symbolic. Ferg explores these ambiguities of intention, ultimately by depicting buildings that are at the same time modernist and totalitarian, or act interchangeably as signs for one another. It is not surprising, therefore, that space and architecture are so central to Ferg and Merz's art. Only architecture, it would appear, can translate these contradictory aims into the necessary public impact. In space, art and society are finally made transparent to one another. Different spaces communicate different characteristics of society at large. Modernist architecture, amongst its many other ambitions in particular, reflects its culture through the uniformity it adopts with regard to its own conventions. Through its own order, the sense of a well-ordered, well-administered society seems to follow. Now, the relations or the installations of Ferg and Merz are not only spatial, they are orderly down to their very last constructive detail. They exude the confidence, even the idealism, of the utterly choreographed. For Ferg especially, this confidence made spatial becomes obvious in certain buildings of the 20s and 30s, where society's well-ordered administration finds architectural extension expressed in every element. Still, the sense of melancholy, the hopeless feeling of recalling a spatial order increasingly unreal, lingers in these works. They thus elicit a kind of uneasy reflection. They demand a kind of meditation upon the perhaps too obvious correlation of an absolute art joined to an absolutist society. While surely not the first time in history, and I suspect not the last, space itself emerges as the site of our own dis-ease. Ferg, for example, presents us with examples from this century's greatest architectural achievements. As I said, Mies House Lange in Krefeld, the Haus Wittgenstein in Vienna, or the less heroic but no less absolutist architecture of Trani's Casa del Fascio, Piacentini's faculty buildings at the University of Rome, or Libra's Villa Malfarte in Capri. In each instance, the silence their photo documentation produces becomes a sign of a dialectical tension which we as viewers cannot possibly reconcile. Thematic ambiguity thereupon leads to our discomfort. Abstract painting with its totalization of form again reveals modernism's claims for a socio-aesthetic uniformity. This becomes quite clear in Ferg's two- and three-dimensional abstractions. Yet this striving for totality becomes its most challenging in Ferg's many photographs. Photo enlargements, almost full scale of monumental colonnades, halls and stairs, where infinite extension and scale make even the idea of redundancy itself absurd. Again, what Ferg and Merz do, I believe, is to exhibit this idea of perfection, only then to have it turn upon itself. Its very rightness, adumbrated again and again, seems only to cast more doubt upon its value as a goal, either to itself or to a greater social administration. In truth, what appears to be going on in Ferg's and Merz's art is something really, I think, complex. The struggle already mentioned at Adorno's paradoxical notion of an autonomous art, an art of negative harmony translated now into the tension between freedom and authority, occurs, I would suggest, also in these installations. The expansive voids in Ferg's and Merz's work are, to say the least, puzzling. At one instant, they appear to be the spaces of openness and freedom. On second encounter, their painted surfaces, their reflected layers, their densified edifices seem oddly mute, their space circumscribed and sealed as if closed off from a social present. Still, whatever their ambiguity, These are also clearly spaces in which society seems to figure itself, to recognize itself through, not despite, abstraction. It is a space that elicits and then rejects freedom and openness, suggesting that even these can be utterly organized and administered. Finally, this is the notion of space rendered totally opaque, space conceived to be experienced, as Leo Bersani terms it, through, quote, an enigmatic display of being, unquote, rather than through interpretation as a set of emblematic signs to be read. In terms of construction, Ferbey and Meretz's work are an art-assisted architecture, or space modeled after the now ubiquitous ready-made. By framing what is in effect an event, they direct the spectator through a temporal narrative of aesthetic modernism's historical collusion with social totalitarianism. That moment in history, of course, resonates now only as a memory. But what these spaces make clear is not merely the strength of memory, but the role of reproduction to preserve memory, that sense of what has been repressed, but now returns in a new, perhaps more insidious guise. Likewise, the audience for whom these spaces might resonate seems really quite specific. One presumes that foremost they are young Germans, a generation for whom a fascist era and one of its greatest legacies, the Holocaust, is now a historical event with but a distant echo. Ferg and Meretz are clearly of that generation born into a Germany that came into being after World War II. This I would distinguish this generation from the Kiefers or the Boys, for example, Joseph Beuys, that is. It may seem ironic then that this generation with such an obvious investment in the future should reinvoke a past which is indeed so troubling. Still, they seem hardly nostalgic, even if their concentration or the concentration of their work appears highly regimented, if technically somewhat dispassionate. Let me put it quite bluntly. Ferg and Meretz are not, it seems to me, revivalists. They appear to the contrary to be extremely conscious of the flawed claims to purity and perfection shared by both an autonomous modernism and a social totalitarianism. Every detail within their work speaks to the dangerously unrealistic, inhumane, and obsessive tendencies of these claims. Yet for a generation that lacks the palpable encounter of this twisted ideal made real, reinstating its forms becomes another way to remember. Granted, it is a historical memory without personal experience. Yet unlike other critics of their work, there is, I think, a wish on the part of both artists to work these memories in some way through, to at the very least feel the tension of a false reconciliation for which the individual coming to terms, for which no individual coming to terms can match the mass deception still present in contemporary culture. Were Ferg and Meretz's work to in fact become more representationally transparent, this, I would argue, would only result in an anguished appearance of difficulty. To the contrary, avoiding even the semblance of deceptive bad faith is essential to an understanding of Ferg and Meretz's work. And by articulating purity and perfection as almost completely aesthetic concerns, they revealed their frightening power to manipulate not just society's perceptions, but the individual's as well. The installations of Ferg and Meretz, then, are really like a theater with many stages. Each artist orchestrates his dramaturgical repertoire. Each exhibits the same directorial control over its many parts. Yet these parts and the harmony they suggest are, to use Adorno's term, negative. Every dramatic device refers to an authoritarian moment, alludes to the historical suffering it has caused, and prolongs the sense of disease it engenders when transformed into art. It is a dramatic harmony as paradoxical as the autonomous modernism to which it indeed refers. Our sense then, perhaps, that there is something not merely unsettling, but even nonsensical, perhaps even absurd in the spaces created by Ferg and Meretz, only increases as their plays go on. for the claims of autonomy not only for the art and architecture they refer to, but of ourselves as free and rational agents able to interpret their meaning becomes more and more questionable. The absurd totality of their installations seems then to only parody our totalizing ambitions to understand and make sense of these historical events, most notoriously of the Holocaust, for which no rationalization can be made, nor even finally represented. While it might be too much to burden the mission of Ferg and Mertz's work with the critique of irrational rationality which Adorno calls for in a truly modern art, at least their problems seem very much the same. The problem finally being that the subject or even society which strives for complete social or aesthetic autonomy turns human reason into a mere instrument of domination. The paradox of social freedom to quickly become unfreedom, of reason to become irrational, of an art of liberation to finally coerce and control, is the absurdity for which this or any art must finally acknowledge. The desperation of this idealism becomes threatening, even tragically pathetic, finds its most profound enactment, perhaps, in another less immediate, though no less contemporary drama, which Adorno refers to repeatedly. The scene is from Samuel Beckett's 1957 play, Endgame. The two characters, Ham and Clove. Ham, take me for a little turn, not too fast, hug the walls, then back to the center again. I was right in the center, wasn't I? Clove, yes. Ham, stop, do you hear? That's enough, back. Clove, we haven't done the round. Ham, back to my place, is that my place? Clove, yes, that's your place. Ham, am I right in the center? Clove, I'll measure it. Ham, more or less, more or less. Clove, there. Ham, I'm more or less in the center? Clove, I'd say so. Ham, you'd say so? Put me right in the center. Clove, I'll go get a tape. Ham, roughly, roughly, bang, in the center. Clove, there. Thank you. Now, I think rather than individual questions, because I guess we're running a little bit late, David has suggested that we go perhaps immediately into
about 15 minutes, 10 minutes, let us have